University of Weather, Mr. Gamble, thank you so much for being here. President Gamble has mentioned he might not go through the budget as he has with the finance committees, but might just talk to us about the university. President Gamble, if you'd come forward, pleased to have you with us. And I guess before we start, let's mention that who we have here on the Senate. We have Senator Dunleavy way down at the end there, and Senator Gardner here at the table, myself, Stevens, and members of the House.
And we have members of the House, Representative Peggy Wilson, Representative Harriet Drummond, Representative Laura Reinbold, and Representative Paul Seaton, and myself, Lynn Gaddis.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President.
Well, Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pat Gamble, and I'm the president of the University of Alaska System. And with me today, I have several backer-uppers in the room and interested parties, because today we're going to talk just in general about what's going on with the university. We've briefed the budget and talked about the budget to the House and the House Subcommittee and to the Senate Finance Committee. And so I thought this would be an opportunity, instead of going over old ground, to maybe get into some of the areas that time didn't allow in those testimonies and talk more in general about some of the things that are going on, or better yet, where are your interest areas and the items that you'd like to get across to us. I, of course, have loaded my database here to answer every and all question, but never are they the same questions that I'm prepared for that you ask, and so I've got my auto database behind me that can surf up answers as they come up. And if you don't mind, I'll dispense with charts, and I'll just talk a little bit about what's going on with the university. Some of you have recently heard me give this introduction, and some of you are unaware of it, so I better start at the beginning. And I'll fast forward a little bit. About 2.5 years ago, when I came to the university, as a new guy walking in, you know, the first thing you want to do is look around and say, well, what needs doing? What's at the top of the in basket that Mark couldn't get to, but it would have been the next thing? And that takes about 6 months in a complex organization. and I took the 6 months to do just exactly that, visit the campuses and get to know people. And I'm not an educator by trade, but I've been involved in both secondary education and higher education in a number of ways in my previous life in the Air Force, with responsibility for many schools, the cadets at the Air Force Academy. I've been on the board of Air University, which is the degree-granting organization in the Air Force, all the way up through PhD at the Air Force Institute of Technology, visited the laboratories. I've been around higher education, so it was actually a dream job to be able to come in and see what I could do with my background. What I found was not a whole lot of difference from the business world. The tendency is to walk in and say, okay, where's the strategic plan? How are we doing? The strategic plan at the university system needed updating. The information for a 2009 strategic plan is gathered about 2000-2001 timeframe. I came in 2010, and the plan needed updating because it had 2009 printed on the cover, which meant it was already out of date. So the original thing that a new guy does in the corporate world, it's very common, you say, well, let's look at the strategic plan and we'll update it.
Excuse me for a moment. If I could acknowledge all Representative Dan Sadler's presence, thank you.
The process of updating a strategic plan seemed like the thing at the time, but as I got more and more into it, and as I had my chance to come down here for the first time and listen to the concerns of the legislature, listen to concerns from several different sources, I realized there were several areas that probably needed looking into, and as we got more into them, it became aware to me that it isn't the strategic plan per se that needs updating. It really is the system needs to take an introspective look at itself and say, we've been doing this the same way for all these years. Is what we're doing really the right way today? Is it relevant? And why do we do what we do the way we do it? I had the opportunity to sit on the task force and listen to concerns about secondary and post-secondary education and the link between the two, and realized that, no, it's not a strategic plan that we need to update. We really need to go back at a higher level and get ourselves involved at the strategic level in the state with higher education. And that means we've got to go outside our boundaries. But how and where and what do we do? And the idea was, we're not going to go around and everything we find that's wrong or can be improved, we're going to put a Band-Aid on it and call it a fix. Because that doesn't guarantee that you've instilled enduring properties in your changes. Like spring steel, you can put so much energy in, as soon as you turn your back, pow, it goes right back to the way it was. Culture and bureaucracy will do that when you're trying to make large systematic changes. So we hired a friend of the university, Terry McTaggart, who is probably well known to many of you, and he's well known across the higher academic world. And we brought him in and talked about what we had seen, and in the discussion, we realized that we weren't talking about the upgrade to a strategic plan so much as we're talking about changing the direction of the university, like you would change the direction on a ship, change the vector, but don't slow things down, stop things, or put a fence out there and say we're going to get to this fence in a certain amount of time as if it's a pass-fail item. It's substantive change that has enduring properties that's what's needed. And as a result, we named this effort, this holistic effort to get our arms around all these things that we needed to go in and look at and improve, the Strategic Direction Initiative, or SDI as we call it, because that's a mouthful. And the goal of SDI at the end is that it goes away. When we're done doing what we're going to do, SDI, you don't need a project or a program anymore. We got hundreds of programs. We just need to change the way we do business, and then that becomes us. And so it's not a program anymore, it's the way we are. We're two-thirds of the way through that process now. We're just finishing up the second phase, which consisted of looking at all the current reviews that had been done, including one that I commissioned to bring in a team that's, again, a really high-level team. Rasmussen Foundation funded that effort. We brought the team in, they looked at us from wall to wall. We had about over 80 write-ups, recommendations, suggestions. We had the McTaggart-Rogers report on the staff of the system. We had over 80 listening sessions all across Alaska with students and faculty and alumni and anybody and everybody from the communities where we had our community campuses and other places to tell us what we're doing right, what are we doing wrong, how are we spending your money, are our students getting what they need, your parents and your students yourselves, and we talked to our students to get the world from their point of view, which was really amazing and a lot of fun. And we pulled all this data, and we had a couple hundred pages now of transcripts and data and comments and suggestions and all this information from the studies and so on. Now, what do you do with all this? Well, we actually ran a technical word and subject search where, like a pachinko machine, we started distilling down subject material that were in what we called themes. And five major themes came out of this effort. We're a year and a half into the effort now. So when we were here last year, we were just introducing this idea to members of the respective committees who were on the committees then. This year, we're a whole another year down the road, and several of you in our budget report saw the progress that's been made in the last year with what was awarded to us last year through the appropriations that we put right to work. And it's really been inspiring. But it didn't happen without the total and complete cooperation of the entire system in many ways that were, in fact, the essential problems that we were trying to face, understand, and then go in and ask, why do we do it this way? Transfer of credits is one of the typical ones. Everybody hears the horror stories. If you really want to hear some neat stories, listen to the ones coming from the students. Because our tendency is to look at our system and say, gee, everything's working fine. Our credits transfer. They're supposed to. But you don't know how they transfer. And when you ask the students, they'll tell you, not very well. But on the surface, do they transfer? Sure they transfer. And so you dig down in there and you start finding out that, well, we're a bureaucracy and we're set in our ways and it's sort of do it our way or the highway. But more important than that, we're all over the map on the way we do it in our system. because we've got three separately accredited universities who, during the growth phase of the last 10 to 12 years, which was generously supported here in Juneau, in the growth phase of a company, one of the things you have to worry about is you've got to control growth. And when it grows fast, that actually becomes a problem. And when you've got three independent units within a system who are all growing fast and going in their different directions, then what you would seem to be thinking are done the same way in those three universities are being done entirely different. And that is what is still confronting us and what we're working on hard. The good news is, after a year and a half, we've made amazing progress. And why is that? Well, first of all, we've got an organization that understands this process and has worked it very well. We've got cooperation on the academic side of the house, where everybody thought we were going to have these horrendous problems. We've got cooperation on the faculty across the system, using the governance process where you have faculty representation across the system. And they're meeting some of these issues that have been bothering us for years head on. And they're coming to the conclusion that, in fact, there are some things they can do. Now, helping us along is the fact that in the lower 48 over the last 4 years, there have been some huge budget cuts in some of the largest universities that we have. And they've been driven under a sense of urgency into almost a survival mode to go out and try things that universities have only talked about doing, but they've never really had the courage to just go do it. And that means you've got to break some glass, and you do have to have courage to say, all right, I will change. Not only will I talk about it and study it, but I will change. And they did. And the California school system is a great example. I mean, the greatest school system in the nation was basically cut to the bone, broken up, badly damaged, bruised, but it's putting itself back together now. And when it does, it's going to be a better system than when it started. And we're seeing that in a number of other school systems as well, because they're doing some things they always should have. Well, now we're in a position, because we have not had those huge budget cuts, we're able to do it on a programmatic basis with the cooperation of the legislature, not out of frustration of the legislature. And we can go cherry pick the best of breed from down in the lower 48 of these good ideas and see which ones, if we migrate them into our system, really would work in Alaska for Alaskans. And that's important, because one of the questions that a university has to ask itself is, who are we as a university? What are we? What is it we do? I give the same example, and pardon me if I repeat, but I mean, it's the one that works best for me. If I go to an Eastern private college, I may never take a math course, and I may study the Great 100 books, and I may get a wonderful education after 4 years. And that's what they do. That's who they are, and that's what they do, and that's how they give their education to their students. The opposite of that, and I say this sort of jokingly, is they would look down their nose at an engineering university. I use Caltech because that's a great school. They would look down their nose and say, you know, that's a trade school. They go in there and they get their hands dirty and funny smells in laboratories, and they wear hard hats and boots. And Caltech would turn around and say, yeah, but that's who we are, and we're the best in the world at it. And so what are we? We have to answer that question. And I think, first and foremost, we are Alaska's university for Alaska's needs. And that means we're workforce development oriented as well as higher degree oriented. Our people are interested in, for the most part, staying in Alaska and working on what drives Alaska, our economy and our way of life. And so we have engineers and we have liberal arts majors and we have teachers and we have those who want to get more involved in the culture of Alaska and Alaskan natives and history and anthropology and so on and so forth. And that's where we're orienting a lot of our programs. That's who we are. We are Alaska's university. And a big part of what we do is our workforce development. So with all that in mind, now SDI is saying, all right, we've come through two phases. We've got these themes. We know who we are. We know what we want to do. We know we're bureaucratic and we got to clean up those kinds of things. you know, when you dial that number and you don't get a human on the other end and you talk to a computer and then you wait and, I mean, we do stuff like that. It drives the students nuts. And we know we do that, but we're reluctant to say that. We think we've got everything wonderfully handled, and what we're finding out is we can do better. Continuous improvement is a basic fundamental desire of any business or any institution, and we're no different. But the last phase of the phase threes, as we go through all this, is, all right, what is it? You know, we know we want to make some improvements in this area and these major areas, but what do we want to come out looking like in these areas? What is the effect that we want to achieve in something like relationships with our high schools? What is the effect we want to achieve? Why are better relations with the high schools important? And so you ask the why question, and you keep drilling down. When you get an answer, you ask why. When you get that answer, you get another answer and you say, okay, got it. Now, why is that? When you can't go any farther, you're probably getting close to really what you're trying to find out. And that's where solutions lie, is down in that zone. And that's the methodology that we're using. And so in this third phase, we have to get the question framed right. What is the effect we're trying to achieve in transfer of credit? Something as simple as that title is very complex. Across three separate systems, 13 community campuses, different cut scores, different nuances to basic classes like English or math, but they're different, but yet they count as a basic course for a student. These are the things that in the system look like they should have some commonality, but we've never really gone in and discussed that. We're doing that now with the leadership of the faculty, because when you get into this methodology, it automatically leads you down that path. You can't ignore it. It takes you down that path, and you say, to solve this problem, this has got to happen. So we're looking at these themes, and we're saying, what's the intended effect? And if we get a good statement of what we want, and everybody agrees and say, yeah, that's the outcome we want, then there's only so many ways from where you are to get to where you want to be. One of them may take 10 years. Nope, can't do that. It's too long. One of them may take $10 million. Nope, can't do that. It's too expensive. And you work your way down to the most likely way to get to that effect. And there is where the glass breaking comes in. Yeah, but to do that, holy smoke, you know what we have to do compared to what we're doing now? And that's where you break the glass. And that's where the courage comes in. Can you break the glass? Can you sweep it away and go forward and agree that that's what we're going to do? Do you still want that effect? Yes, we do. Okay. What are the alternatives? Well, there really isn't an alternative. We've got the best alternative. Okay, let's do it. It may require resourcing, but in a lot of cases, it's just internal. It's more efficient, it's more effective, or it's working internal resources, freeing up something that's not adding value and taking those dollars and putting them over where something does add value. That's why we come in and ask for a single appropriation, for example, so that you have the flexibility among the chancellors and the president to move money around internally without everything being additional and an add-on, which we have more of a tendency to do with the current 7 appropriations that we have now. So that's what SDI is all about. We're having a meeting on the 20th of February. There will be a very large meeting of the leadership of the university system, about 45 of the leadership across the system. We'll come back and join Terry McTaggart, and we will finish out phase two, and we will start the process of saying, okay, we've got all the data we need, what's the effect we want to achieve, and begin phase three. I won't use the light at the end of the tunnel speech, because as I like to say, you know, at the end of the marathon, there's Heartbreak Hill, or at the end of the Tour de France, there's the Pyrenees. It isn't necessarily easy just because you're getting closer to the end. This may be the hardest part of all, is for everybody to take a big gulp and say, okay, we're going to be different when we do this. And a lot of it is going to have to be agreed to across the whole system. And in times past, that was very, very difficult to do. Let me finish this little introduction by saying that could not do it without the cooperation of the three chancellors. Right now, we've probably got the best team of chancellors and provosts and academic leaders and governance leaders that we could have for this to be done. And that means the probability of success is very high. I'm not worried about that anymore. I know we can do it. We just need to get it right. And that's what we're all about. That's everything we're doing that was reflected in our budget. Those major themes were reflected in our budget. Student-oriented, student-output-oriented, outputs rather than inputs is the name of the game, and not necessarily reliant on more money, more money. It's reliant on smarter, faster, harder, those kinds of things as well. So I'll stop there.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. I really appreciate your candor and your willingness to sit down and have a sort of a fireside chat with us. It was very, very nice, and I really appreciate that, not to get into the budget issues, which, of course, our finance committees will be dealing with. But I appreciate the fact that we can just sit here and talk as education committee about the issues that that you're dealing with. Certainly a lot of pride in the university and what has been accomplished, and I know we'll be hearing later from you from the university on teacher training, and that's always a crucial issue to us. But so many things that are going on out there that, will we be seeing that McTaggart report? Will that be made available to the general public when it is published?
Well, the actual official McTaggart report was done actually a couple of years before I even came to the university. Mm-hmm. And that report just covered the system-wide staff. It was just the staff.
So this is a further working of that report.
McTaggart is acting as a consultant on our behalf. He knows us very, very well by now. He's done a lot of good work for us, and so we have that advantage. And he's acting as sort of a consultant facilitator for these large meetings and keeping us focused. And this may be the last meeting that we have with him before we're finished with using him. Mm-hmm. But he won't publish a report. What we do is we take meeting notes, and those meeting notes are certainly available if somebody wanted to look at them. We transcribe what we did in the meetings, and I have no problem letting anybody look at those.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. Well, I have read that McTaggart report, and it was very, very interesting, and I really had a great look into the university. As I said, there's so many programs out there that and things the university is doing that we can be proud of in research and ANSEPT. I'd appreciate hearing any thoughts you have on the ANSEPT program. That seems to be one that we can all salute. It's worked well.
My interest in the ANSEPT program is certainly not the standard interest of worrying about funding and those things. I mean, people are standing in line to support ANSEPT because it is so successful in what it does. My interest is in doing the analysis, and I've sat down with Herb a couple times, you know, to try to figure out what makes this program work. And is that expandable, and is that something that we can expand to other than just Native Alaskan students? There are certain qualities to that program that appear to be better than virtually any other program that we have immediately available. Tapping into those qualities and understanding how you're getting to the students and what makes the students stay with it. And the idea that they discovered that math and science is fun, it's difficult, you got to work, but it's entirely attainable. Those are the qualities that we need to pass on when we deal with the high schools to try to keep the high school students motivated. And as Herb will tell you, you know, he starts early, and if they're building those computers in the sixth grade, you know, what he told me was, you grab those students and you never let them go. Because once you lose them, getting them back, especially when they get older, gets tougher. And when they glaze over and nothing's happening and they goof off their senior year and they don't do anything that summer and suddenly try to enter a college course, they are totally unprepared. And so we put them into remediation. And what does that do? The national data says that's a miserable failure the way it's being done. You put somebody in a semester or even a year, take their money, 40% dropout rate in remediation. If they only have to take one remedial class, a math class or an English class, they've probably got about somewhere between a 15 and 20% chance of ever graduating from college. If they have to take a math class and an English class in remediation, they've got about a 9 or 10% chance of ever graduating from college, no matter how long they stay in. And yet, we're raising their expectations that we're somehow going to have bridged the gap between high school and college preparedness. So that model is broken, and we're looking at models like Herb's to be able to apply and work with our high schools to see if we can do better.
Thank you. I'd like to open it for questions now. Representative Ledoux.
So what's the graduation rate for the ANSEP students? from college graduation?
I'd ask Herb, because he probably has that on the tip of his tongue, and he's here in the room.
72% of students who enroll in ANSA ultimately graduate with a science or engineering degree from the university. That's starting freshman year.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's compared to about a 30% graduation rate of all students moving through college, trying to get some sort of a degree or certificate, less for a four-year degree.
Through the chair. So what would it take to expand ANSA so that, it was extended beyond the native villages and into the public school system?
Well, first of all, we need to validate the methodology, and Herb has already done that. He's watched ANSEP work in other places other than Alaska. That's huge, because that means we're really onto something. That means that the fundamentals, the basics, the attributes that are built into that program appear to be universal with students. And in some cases, students that are really tough to retain in a college-level course. And I think one of the secrets, and it is expandable, and one of the secrets is this idea that the motivation has got to be there in the classroom somehow. We've got to be sensitive to what today's younger students, now we're principally talking about students that are going through high school and we would like to move directly into college, not the non-traditional student who's a part-time worker, a part-time mother worker that is taking a long time to graduate, but a four and go, as I call them, the high school students. The idea that their whole life culturally today is around communication, and that means your hands doing something, these are going away. iPads are much more usable than a laptop. A desktop is practically not used by the younger students. And so everything is going onto a phone or something that you can hold in your hand. And that technology is moving forward so fast. I mean, the next thing it's going to be is a pair of goggles, and you're going to wirelessly communicate. I don't know what it's going to be, but I do know that they recreate with it, they communicate and socialize with it. We need to integrate educating in there somewhere, and we need to use that in order to move them forward. If we don't catch up with them, and they're up here saying, hey, come on, catch up with us, make it happen, college, university. If we don't, they're going to leave us. And a few smart organizations, whether they're for-profits or whether they're just really progressive universities, are going to get the students, because they're going to go online and they're going to get their degrees and they're going to do it the way they want. So I think the secret in expanding it is to, like Herb says, grab the students young, get them involved, get their hands dirty. Let them see the excitement and the fun. Our undergraduates who go into research in the university, they retain and they love getting involved as undergraduates in research. We do more of that in Alaska than most other states. Most states you have to be in graduate school to actually go in and do research and get in the labs. And that's the way we go forward. And we don't turn loose of them. And by that I mean, there are new and exciting ways to teach courses online where if I'm a mediocre instructor standing up in front and I'm not the world's greatest, there are some world's greatest, and you can build those into a course and put them online and use techniques that today's students really resonate with. So why would I want half a loaf when I can get best of breed, and it's probably cheaper too? So where's the focus? The focus is on the high-tech classroom and the ability to put your hands on something, and less on the focus of the standard lecture and lecture hall with sitting in the front or back row.
Thank you. We're going to go to Senator Gardner and then Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. You spoke a little bit about remediation classes, and there was recently an article in the, I think, Anchorage Daily News about the Merit Scholarship Program and how many students had been involved in that, and that the remediation need was way down, and I was stunned that there'd be any need for remediation on the Merit Scholarship program. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Let's first of all recall that that is a fairly new program, and that all the standards that are built into the program, you know, we sort of grandfathered the first group of students that came in. They didn't have to have the full 4 years, you know, and some of the rigor in some of the schools was not there, and they couldn't participate. But we sort of eased into that. So we're expecting that the initial statistical information will probably get better. Second, it's a three-tiered system, which means that you can participate with about a C-plus average. Meeting certain qualifications, you have a shot at getting part of a scholarship, you know, at about a C-plus average. And then there's a middle tier and there's a top tier. And as you might expect, the top tier is doing fine. Middle tier, a little less. But the third tier is the one where we need to really pay attention, because they're the ones that the early initial indicators suggest that the old bugaboo about not quite being ready for college is starting to get to them. And we are remediating scholarship winners. There's no question about that. We are remediating scholarship winners, and not all of them are getting through. So we're going to have to go back, and like any other program, it's a great idea, it has a lot of merit, but it may need tweaking along the way and some adjustments along the way. The best way to do that is one of our themes is better partnerships with the high schools in Alaska, and I think we can work some of those bugs out. I feel confident that the program has a lot of merit. We have our own UA Scholars Program. Mm-hmm. Top 10% of any school, if you're in the top 10%, you're eligible to be a UA Scholar. And likewise, if you go in and look at the success rate of those, depending on the quality of the school and the rigor in the coursework, there's a lot of ups and downs in that one, because it's just a top 10%. And the top 10% in one school and another may be different, and so it may be harder for some of those kids to be successful. We've got some work to do on that too, and we're looking into those numbers. Actually, our databases are much more improved over the last couple of years than they've ever been, and we're able to really get some really good information that in the past really wasn't there and available to us like it is today.
Thank you. And I have another question, Mr. Chair.
If you wouldn't mind, we have several people lined up. We'll go to Representative Reinbold, and then Dunleavy, Seaton, and Ledoux, and get back to you, Gardner. Representative Reinbold.
First, a comment, please, through the chair, and then a question. First of all, I want to say thank you for, I've seen you many times over the last couple of years in presentations, and my comment is you don't try to make things look rosier than they are. You're very factual. You bring things the way that they are. You tell us when there's a problem, and then I've even personally brought problems that I'm sure many people have to you, and they're getting addressed. And I just would like to make a commentary that it's appreciative that you're responsive.
Thank you.
My question to you is technology. I'm all about technology. I have been in several classrooms. I do have a 17 and 19-year-old, so this is kind of the age, you know, that my kids are right now. What my concerns are about technology is people seem to think that if you put an iPad or a cell phone or something in a kid's hand, then that's technology. And yes, I agree. I'm all about technology. However, implementing those is a big concern to me, making sure that there's parameters and they're used for the right reasons. They're not out of date. We don't spend $16 million on these, then they're, you know, didn't achieve the effect that we wanted them to achieve. So implementing them. So what my question to you is there a research based in Europe? I used to live in Europe, and so, you know, I know they're more advanced than we are in some of our cell phones. Things that they're using over there. Is there an outcome based study that shows that using these tools as a model, like in Finland or something, where a lot of these are made, a lot of iPhones are made, is there an outcome-based study that shows that they were able to implement them successfully and it did improve the outcomes in education?
You know, one study does not immediately come to mind on that, but let me take that question and go looking, because I think we can probably find the evidence and give it back to you. I'd throw part of the interest in your question up for grabs, though, and that is the rate at which that technology is finding its way into the hands of students and then into the hands of the universities and colleges. One of the real difficult parts of funding, as you mentioned, not wasting the money, is the fact that the upgrades are coming so fast. Which one do you pick? And then what's the half-life of that upgrade? I love the argument about, well, you got to have the face-to-face contact. You can't substitute not having a teacher in front of the class. What we're seeing is modifications of that. The flipped class, for example. The flipped class says the lesson is learned online. The homework is done by you and the teacher in the class. And the teacher goes to the students who are having difficulty and helps them with the homework, as opposed to standing in front of the class trying to move the whole class forward at the same time and leaving some people in the dust. Well, that's already happening. What's the next level? And the one that I like the best is, well, you got to use the technology. No, you got to have the face-to-face time. I think that within 10 years, I mean, we have simulators now where you're flying an airplane and other airplanes are flying around you in real time, in real relative position. You're talking in real time. They're your wingman. But you're in Florida. Your wingman is flying out of Washington State. The bad guys are flying out of the National Guard unit on the East Coast. And yet you're all in this 360-degree digitized real world where if I go down low enough and I've got a digital map of Beirut, I can fly down the main street of Beirut and I will see what I see if I walk down the main street of Beirut. Now apply this in the classroom. Here's all your students around you. They're all in this mixed class with technology piping them in. You're wearing a set of goggles that have about 160 degrees of reference, and wherever you look, the real students and their faces are right there with you. So it's not an either-or situation anymore. Technology brought it all together and said you get the best of both. That's where we're going, and we've got to be smart about when we buy into those kinds of things. I'm not sure we want to break trail on those sorts of things, but I also don't want to be the last. If something like that really works and the students love it, we need to go after it. That's our future, I think.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through the chair. Just very briefly, I would suggest through the chair that the committee entertain having Mr. Schroeder come at a future date to sit down for some time and explain what's basically a turnkey operation, starting back in sixth grade and working all the way through graduation. I think that model, I think we can learn a lot about that model. And one of the things that I hope we take away today is he's dealing with a Native Alaskan population which traditionally does very poorly in college, which we spend a lot of our remediation focus on. But the bottom line is, if you have the right system for any of the kids, any kids, they're going to succeed. And just a comment, the slight comment, we're using remediation and developmental interchangeably, and they're really two different things. When you're dealing with a student in high school that hasn't had something yet, it's really developmental. When you're dealing with somebody in college or high school that's had something and you're going over again, it's really remediation. And sometimes it gets us hung up, but there's important differences there. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, on the Higher Education Task Force, there were two items that we were looking at in there that were looking at individual progress through and completion rates. Specifically, the one was the individual required advisor advocate for any institution taking the performance scholarship. And I understand that the university has been moving through that and putting some advisor positions so that anybody seeking a degree that's mandatory. I'd like a little update on how successful you are on that. And the other portion of that was on remediation and the poor track of a class that everybody has to take if you just miss a cut score, instead of a variable amount of remediation to make up for where you are below. I mean, it's, you know, the kid that really is really struggling with English gets the same English course as somebody that, you know, was one question away from passing the placement test. So can you let us know whether you are integrating the those remediations in those close cases within and at the same time as the other courses, or is it still becoming sequentially? You have to pass this math score or something before you can take, or an English course before you can take other courses. courses?
Well, both of those are very much a part of SDI. I mean, they're main themes that we're looking at in SDI. The one that's out in front of the other one is the advising. Last year, advising to the tune of about $1.1 million was received and put to use. I'll use UAA as an example in this one. UAA started out with a test program and an application called MapWorks that was specifically designed to help advisors who had a lot of students that they had to be responsible for know about the student they were advising. And we were experimenting with this application to see, well, what all can it do for us? And as I recall originally, the first time I saw it and was really impressed by its potential, they were, I think, engaging about 400 students at UAA, and they were trying this out. Today, they have over 5,000 students involved in MapWorks, and it's specifically for what we call comprehensive advising. And it has we wanted to get it to freshmen and sophomores. Those are the two first priorities that we wanted to get it to, and we have at UAA. Those who are degree-seeking but are in a longer program, but they're still taking 100-level courses, for example. We've got it covered for those folks. We're trying to buy the addition, and I have to check and see if it came as part of that 1.1, but we wanted to make sure it got to all the community campuses so that everybody had an equal opportunity to use this application. The good news is that since last year, just in the intervening year, we're already starting to see some benefits from the application in terms of one feature of this is called an early alert. And so instead of that student that didn't show up next semester and you wondered what happened to him, you actually have a better chance to intervene with a student who's starting to get in trouble because of their communication with their file in MapWorks. You know, they talk to each other about the most intimate things, and they won't talk to an advisor about the most basic things, but they'll talk to a file. And what we're doing is breaking down those barriers. We've had 65 students that UAA considers probable saves, and that goes right to the bottom line for us. That's retention, and retention is a dollar issue for a university. So already we're starting to see the benefit of that, and we want to expand that program. So this comprehensive advising, we saw it work in the lower 48, and it looks like it's going to work well here as well. And with e-learning and all the different complexities and alternative ways of putting together coursework and progressing, you really need advisors because it gets very complex. And then with your status as a student, if you've got a scholarship, you know, your status has to be right or you don't get your full scholarship money, and all those things are very confusing to a young student, and advisors are absolutely essential. The second part, also very interesting, we use, since last year, in the intervening year, we use AccuPlacer as a placement tool. We mandated it across the system that if you're coming into the UA system, you've got to take AccuPlacer. Well, that's great. And we got together and we agreed on that, and it took a while, as you might expect. But then we found out that, as you said, well, the cut scores aren't the same. And so if I come from one school in one district, and I want to go to UAF, and don't quote me on the numbers, but let's say the cut score for English is 51, but I want to go to UAA, and the cut score is 55, and I got a 53, what does that do? And so the faculty got together and just recently aligned cut scores across the whole system. That's a huge step in terms of cooperation, and my hat's off to them. Then the next thing they've taken up is... and they did this with the first basic English course. Now they're looking at the math course, taking it one step at a time. You know, accreditation is a blanket that falls over all of this. You can do things in academia, but somebody's looking over your shoulder to make sure that you're doing what you said you were going to do and doing it right and maintaining your standards. And so that also is a big concern, and that's why our faculty are the ones that are really the ones to make these kinds of things work. We're looking at the harmonization or standardization of certain basic GRE courses so that a course is a course is a course in those first year or two. when then you finally may declare a degree and start taking more advanced courses, it gets more difficult, depending on your major. But a lot of the liberal arts and some of the early engineering and sciences all sort of stem from the same GERs. And so why couldn't those GERs be more aligned? And the faculty is busy at work doing that. They're busy at work doing e-laboratories, where instead of going in there in the lab and mixing the chemicals and so on and so forth, we've gotten to the point that if you have the bandwidth, you can do e-laboratories. And the only thing that you can't feel the liquid on your fingers when it burns and you can't smell the sulfur. But other than that, they're getting better and better and better, where you actually move the test tube on the screen, pour the liquid into, and if you make a mistake, it kills you right there. You know, you made a mistake. But the beauty is, you can stop and back up. When I went through a lab, if I made that mistake about two-thirds of the way through the allotted time, I was dead in the water. All my notes were wrong. I had to go back and do it again, but I didn't have the time on the clock to do it. The class was up. So I'd have to go borrow somebody else's notes. Well, what did you get? How did it work? The beauty of eLabs is you can back it up and run it three or four times until you really understand what you're doing and what's happening. So again, technology, better education, better creative thinking, really learning instead of just memorizing. This is all happening in the last year since we were here the last time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Could I follow up on the developmental courses or the remediation courses? Have we gotten to, okay, somebody got a 49 instead of a 51 and somebody else got a 30? Are they both thrown into the same full semester course, or do we have some variability so that people have to, I mean, they don't have to learn what they already passed, but they are making up for what they don't know to get them to that level? And, you know, that's been a real frustration, I know, across the university, because you've got students that could make it, that just get discouraged and are tired of relearning what they've already demonstrated on the test that they knew those portions of it. Have we made it to that level of variable requirement based on where they were in their testing?
No, we have not. Within SDI, that's a major effort that is just beginning to be underway. The recognition of what you just described has been done. What to do about it is something that's going to have to, again, be looked at across the whole system, and we're just in the first steps. I had a principal at, I think it was a Kodiak High School. It might have been at Kodiak, I believe it was, who gave me the case of a young student who missed the cutoff on Accuplacer by 1 point. Kind of what you were describing, you know, somebody has a bad day, missed the cutoff by 1 point. The math teacher said, this is one of my best students. This student can do college work. The day they walk out of this high school, they're going to be ready for that first math course. There is no way you need to put them in remedial classwork. Right now, our remedial classwork basically is the semester, you know, approach. The fast tracking, the just-in-time, the intensives, those are all options we're looking very closely at, because we recognize that that's probably the way to go. But also, there's got to be some understanding, I think, in the case of if a math teacher is willing to write a letter and say, this is one of my best kids, he just had a, I don't know why he got that low score, but he got that low score. Maybe he had a bad day at home, I don't know. If I got a letter from a math teacher in high school that said that about a student, I wouldn't think twice about saying, yeah, missed it by 1 point, good grief. But we are what we are. You know, here's the cutoff, here's the score, sorry, that's the way it works. And those are the kinds of things we're saying, look, we're better than that. That isn't service to our students. That's a bureaucracy talking there. And that's a good example of what I was mentioning before, that we need to have more understanding.
Thank you. And we'll go on to Representative Ledoux and then Senator Gardner.
I was just wondering, and maybe we need to leave this for Mr. Professor Schroeder, but if you can answer the question, what would it take to implement an ANSA-type program in the Anchorage Public Schools? Or take any district anywhere.
One of the biggest questions we have is that some of the bridging programs that are very successful. Let's take a microscopic version of an ANSET program. It's got another name. It's got 10 students, and it's got a very high success rate for maybe the same reasons that ANSEP has. It's not native oriented, but it's just a successful bridging program. Works for 10 students. More difficult to do for 100 students, impossible to do for 1,000 students. That's the scaling problem that we have. So the fundamental features of ANSEP that make it successful, I personally believe, are scalable. But to cost that out, build a program, actually build it and cost it out for thousands of students in the school districts across Alaska, I don't know what the answer to that question is. I think it certainly is worth looking at. And if we could replicate ANSEP without having to build something new and special that would be applicable on that scale, I think that would be wonderful. Obviously, it would have to be resourced, and that's a step farther than we've taken at this particular point in time. As I said before, I think Herb has validated ANSEP concepts because it worked. And when you get him in here to talk, and he will explain it much more, it's worked in other places with other Native student groups. And Hawaii comes to mind, and in the Southwest region, I think. And I think it has the potential to work on a much larger scale, but I don't think we've officially costed it out, and that would be a step that would have to be taken.
Through the chair. How would we go about doing that?
We could do that internally. I mean, we could do that internally with the folks that we have at the university and take a really good first guess to see if the concept has traction. And then we would probably turn it over to some sort of a consultant that would come in and do a real definitive piece of work as to how that would work. That's where the cost would start to accumulate. I mean, for something potentially as beneficial, the investment would certainly be worth it if it looks like this is a scalable to the size and scope of Alaska school districts.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've already touched on the transferability of credits, and it is the one hot button issue when I talk to people, but to students about the university, they find it so frustrating. And I realize that a big part of that problem is we think of it as one university with a bunch of campuses, but you're talking about the accreditation as being separate. And so that it's really three different universities in that sense. If you're at UAS and you want to go to UAA, you have to get it. It's not. So we've asked about this many times on the record during these overviews and presentations, and the university's always working on that. Can you give us any sense of when we could tell people this problem is really resolved? Or they can tell us?
We'll know when we don't have any complaints for a year. I mean, I would hate to go plant the victory flag and do the dance in the end zone because we're working on it. Because we keep finding out different things. Do the credits transfer? We've got a study that says 97% of them do. Question is, how do they transfer? Mm-hmm. And if you start asking the students, you start hearing the horror stories, as I call them. That's being a little unfair, but you kind of dramatize these things, you know. So I call them horror stories. And when you offer the opportunity to go online and do so many things online, but then it doesn't work the way it's intended, the other end of the problem has to be working very, very hard to make sure that any and all glitches are resolved and taken out of the system. And what you begin to see is that to do that, you've got to have system-wide cooperation. You've got to have the IT underpinnings. You've got to have something as simple as, from a student perspective, I don't want to have to log in to three separate universities with three separate passwords. I belong to the University of Alaska. I want my credits to transfer. As the head of the student coalition said at one of our meetings, from a student's perspective, we don't care about all that stuff you're working on. We just want it to work. And we can go online and we can sign up for a course and it'll be accepted and it'll transfer and so on and so forth. And our answer has always been, well, they do. But as we were talking about a little earlier, some of the mistakes are the students' mistakes. They want to change majors to a similar major at the other school, but the requirements are different because they're not the same major. They want to make it the same, and they think it should be the same, but the fact of the matter is it isn't, and accreditation will never let it be the same. So if I want to shift from civil engineering to mechanical engineering, and I want to transfer certain courses over because they're engineering courses, that isn't good enough. It's got to be the right courses. Now, down at the GER level, that's where we probably can make the most progress, and that's where we're working on it right now. And when I say we're working, we're not talking about it. They're actually at work. They're actually having meetings with representation from all the campuses to come in and sit down and say, how do we actually do this, and load it into the system. We've never been that far along before. So I'm encouraged that we're going to solve the problem. But the IT piece of it starts to get involved here too. IT is now just absolutely essential to everything mm-hmm. that we do. And it offers students choices. And we offer these students the choices and then make it difficult for them to exercise their choice. And that's what SDI is trying, what I call the hassle factor. We're trying to take that out so that the choice is really the choice. And you can go online, sign in one time, and do what you're supposed to do online. There are some things we can offer more of online, and we fully expect to do that. Have we solved the problem yet? No. We're in the crawl, walk, run. We're trying to stand up. We're at about that stage. But as little kids do, they progress pretty fast, and I think we'll move this along quite well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy?
Oh, I was just saying if you could have a quick at ease.
Brief at ease? Certainly, we'll do that. A brief at ease, sir. Yeah. Thank you. We'll come back together. I appreciate a little break here. We'll move on to Representative Wilson and then Representative Seaton. And so we'll go on to Representative Seaton first.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was wondering, you know, there's a big initiative across the country for this $10,000 degree program. A number of states are aligning with that. I just saw, I think it was all of the universities in Texas agreed. And of course, there is a an amount that has to be taken in high school, dual credits and those kind of things. Has the University of Alaska looked at that as far as moving towards some kind of a streamlined program for students that want to go through that extra preparation so that they're moving forward at that clip?
No, we have not formally looked at anything like the $10,000 degree program. Really, and I think your point is well made, it's not the fact that it's $10,000, it's the fact that in order to get through so fast, you're not accumulating cost like you do if you stay in for 7 or 8 years. And so fundamental to that, and I'm familiar with the Texas, that was the first one to try it out, and everybody thought that the governor was crazy when he said it, but now other states are picking it up. And the secret to it is you need to take as many credits as you can in high school, and then you need to use your summers, and you need to plan your degree program, and then hopefully get the right classes in the right order. And if everything works just perfect, and you're not counting your living expenses and all those kinds of things, you're just counting, doesn't count fees, doesn't count books, but it counts tuition, basically. And we have not looked at it in that sense. Now, are we trying to get more kids credits in high school? Absolutely. And we've got some programs working on that are coming on fast. Are we trying to get them faster through college through the use of e-learning and these crunch courses where everybody has to take the course, but it's first come, first serve, and you know you have to wait your turn and go an extra semester and absorb the costs? We're looking at those kinds of things. So the components are there that we're looking at, but we've never packaged it like the $10,000 degree and put a label on it.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really want to commend you on dealing with the transfer credits, because this is my 13th year, and the first year I was here, legislators were complaining about it. And so finally, that is a joy to hear. Thank you.
We have one of our professors sitting behind me, and I'm so glad he's hearing you all say this firsthand, because he is a leader in the academic side of the house, and will take these words back. So thank you for the point.
Thank you. Representative Rainbow.
Okay, thank you. And once again, I'm going to address the same issue. This is a question I'm asking in honor of a guest in the audience right now. And again, it's on transfer credits, which I know you and I have spoken many times in the past. I can't help it. I feel I need to do justice to this question. He said that he's had a good time transferring credits from the University of Southeast to the University of Fairbanks. However, some credits that transferred from outside, when he went to school outside, did not transfer in. So what the question is to me, and abroad, is of course we all want to get our graduation rates up. We want to get a trained workforce. And we want you to be able to generate revenues from tuition. And I think the key to do that is there's a short window of opportunity. And sometimes if we chase those students away when those credits don't transfer, you know, we've lost our opportunity. And there's a domino effect for years and years and years. It impacts that student's life forever. So what my question to you is there a percentage of transfer credits like Montana State? They have one online, and so you can tell exactly what credits are going to transfer. I think that's a great model to look at. So what percentage are we working on the transfer credits in? Because there's a lot of students that are going out for a year and coming back, and I'm sure you're addressing this as well.
A little bit more of a difficult situation transferring in, but I will say this. What we're seeing in the lower 48 for other schools that feel exactly the same way is they're getting together and forming a coalition. And ahead of time, they're getting the work done to compare, especially in the first 2 years, those basic courses and getting out of the way the business of approving those courses for transfer anywhere in their coalition. Because right now, Professor Abel Biltito here may get a request to look at an outside transfer coming into a biology course, and he will have to sit down and look at that course and then look at our major and our requirements and then make a judgment on the two. Depending on when that request comes in, he's got a lot of other things that are going on too, and so timing for that student may not be in sync with timing for him because he's working on other things, or it's the summertime, or whatever. So the idea that you form a coalition with other interested peer schools, where let's say most of our students that don't go in Alaska do go, like Montana State or Boise State or some of those, and work those out ahead of time, that's a very distinct possibility. But in some cases, and this is where accreditation is very important, you've got to do that to satisfy accreditation. You've got to do that, and the accreditation folks, when they come in, will look very carefully at that. But it can be done. And in fact, one of the things we're seeing is that most of our transfer students that are coming into us are coming in with a sophomore equivalent level credits. And we're trying to bring as many of those in as we can, but we have to go through this process of examining those credits. If they're coming in from the military, the Department of Defense and the services, the Air Force, for example, has the Community College of the Air Force. The Department of Defense has already looked at all those courses and has made arrangements with universities and schools all across the country to automatically accept the majority of those courses right into workforce development, for example, a AA degree or a certificate. And we do that too. So it kind of depends, I guess, is the answer. The day that we just simply accept somebody who's going through engineering at one school and they automatically get all their credits accepted coming into us, I don't see that happening that simple. But I do see some opportunity to join with other universities and have this reciprocal agreement going that could make the process a whole lot easier and more automatic.
Thank you. I appreciate the question. I appreciate the progress that has been made on transferability. Certainly, everything is not transferable. It's simply not. And it's very difficult to decide to make sure that what you have in a class in Fairbanks is, in fact, what a professor covered in a class in Oregon. And I appreciate the difficulty you have with that, and don't expect automatically everything to be transferred. Yes, Senator Gardner.
Just in response, Mr. Chair, the University of California, I went 2 years to University of California at Irvine, transferred to the University of California, Riverside, straight across, no problem. It was one university.
Well, now, internal to Alaska, I mean, those are two big systems, the Cal State system, the California system, mm-hmm. And I think as a result of those huge budget cuts, they're doing some really cutting-edge things down there. But I believe they're pre-approving, and have for some time, they're pre-approving a lot of those courses. So you don't have to go through an individual sit down and look at lesson by lesson and see if it's compatible. The faculties have already agreed. They've done that work. The accreditation agrees with it, and it's already set in place. Mm-hmm. We should be able to do that internal to our community campuses. And the articulation, as we call it, from let's say getting early credits in high school to moving into a two-year degree and then deciding which of the main campuses that you want to affiliate with, if you decide you do want to do that or stay in a community campus, that's the realm that we need to remove the obstacles so that any of those choices all work and they work seamlessly. That's the goal we're aiming at right now.
To be one university. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, very well. I think we've exhausted the questions. I appreciate, Mr. President, your spending time with us, and Representative Gattis, I appreciate your willingness to work together on this and have one hearing instead of having you meet with two different committees and various House and Senate. But certainly appreciate the comments you've made, and thank you very much, sir. Best of luck in this coming academic year, and we'll look forward to seeing you when we have the university here to talk about teacher education.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let me say, the interest expressed by the committee is in just talking about education as opposed to just the budget piece of education. I mean, speaking for everybody, we really appreciate that, because sometimes we feel like people just don't understand the difficulties that we go through trying to do the things you want us to do and that our students and parents want us to do. And so taking the time to listen to what's involved rather than getting the short answer, you know, without much substance because we don't have the time. You've taken the time, and we really appreciate that, too. So we'll be happy anytime to talk to any individual member on any of these subjects in more detail, of course.
Thank you, President Geibel. And we're adjourned.